It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll hear about President Obama's new call to protect net neutrality and the idea of a free and accessible internet.
First, according to psychological research, a lot of people overestimate their knowledge and abilities. And here's the weird part. The less people know, the more confident they are in expressing their opinions.
Here's an example cited by our next guest. It's from the Jimmy Kimmel Show's Lie Witness News segment. Here's the setup for this one. The show is asking people on the street what they had thought of this year's State of the Union address from President Obama. The twist is the day before he actually was going to deliver the address.
What did you think of President Obama's State of the Union address last night?
You know, it had different effects on different people. And you know, I just feel those effects affect everybody. You know, like you just got to stay positive. You got to not focus on the negative.
What did you think of President Obama's State of the Union address last night?
I thought it was powerful. I thought that he laid out a lot of the same sort of policies he's been laying out all along.
Did you notice that John Boehner kept falling asleep?
I did. I'm not sure if he was actually asleep or just resting his eyes, as they say. But yeah, it was not the best thing to see on national television. But there we go.
That was another answers. Maybe good for a laugh, but don't feel too smug because our next guest says all of us have moments just like that.
David Dunning joins us now. He's a professor of psychology at Cornell University. He studies accuracy and illusion in human judgment. David, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, staying with that Jimmy Kimmel segment, in a complete vacuum of information, why do so many of us try to come up with an intelligent answer?
Well, there are any number of reasons. Some people might just be bluffing because they want to look knowledgeable. but sometimes when you're watching the bit, you can't help but think that people actually think they have something reasonable to say, even though they're talking about events that never happened. So it can be we're trying to fool other people, but sometimes we fool ourselves by having information in our head that gives us enough to provide an answer, even to things that don't exist.
So that's a key to a lot of your research. Sometimes having some information doesn't necessarily lead to a better decision or solution than having no information.
Well, that's right. Sometimes, you know, the theories we have in our head, the facts, the figures we have in our head can mislead us in terms of what we think and what answers we provide just as much as they lead us to the right answer.
Now, your research with a colleague led to what's been known as the Dunning, that's your name, the Dunning-Kruger effect. And that's getting a lot of attention, I find, when I started looking beyond your article. What is that?
Well, the Dunning-Kruger effect is the fact that incompetent people tend not to know that they're incompetent. That is, they tend to have very little insight into their deficits and into their shortcomings. Now, they may not be as confident as top performers, but they're not that much less confident than top performers, even though they're making a lot of mistakes and even though they're doing a lot of things that, let's say, diplomatically are suboptimal.
So what goes into that? You don't know anything about a topic, and so you feel fairly confident in your knowledge on the topic. Why?
Well, because I think the best way to think about the uninformed, and that's one way to think about who we're talking about, is that the uninformed aren't necessarily uninformed. That is, they don't have nothing in their head. They have something in their head. They have, you know, some facts, figures, ideas, hunches, rules of thumb that they think they can use to cobble up an answer. So that they're not uninformed, they're misinformed. That is, whatever they're using to come up with some sort of response, to solve some sort of problem, just turns out to be the wrong stuff. But it seems reasonable to them.
Are we hardwired to want to have an answer, whether or not it's the right answer?
It's hard to say, I don't know, it appears. And we do want to know the right answer, but also, if you take a look at the way the human organism is set up, we're also very good at spinning answers. We're very good at taking a few disparate ideas, then weaving together some sort of pleasing theory of how we should act, or some sort of notion of what's the best thing to do right now. And that's just a function of the fact that we were born to be storytellers. We were born to be theorizers. We were born to be pattern recognizers out in the world, which is the seat of a lot of our success, the source of a lot of our success. But at times, it's also the source of our undoing.
Now, how do you put this to the test in your research, this Dunning-Kruger effect, this overconfidence in our lack of knowledge?
Well, what we've done through the years, and now other people have done it as well, is we'll give people some sort of test, like a financial literacy or logical reasoning, or some sort of task, like watch college debate teams as they go through the preliminary rounds of a tournament, and just simply ask people how well they think they're doing, and we make sure that we find out how well they're actually doing. And what we discover is that people who are the poor performers tend to dramatically overestimate how well they're doing. So, for example, if a student has just taken an examination in a course, like a psychology course, and they're walking out of the room, we'll ask them, how well did they do? And usually they'll respond that they did well enough to get a B or maybe a B plus. When in fact, the test they just handed in just earned them a D or an F. And it's not the fact that people are faking. They're honest in their assessments. In fact, we'll even pay people up to $100 for honest assessments. But they actually really do think they're doing well in those circumstances where they're doing very poorly.
And I think another test, I don't remember if it was you or a colleague in the research profession, did things like put names of real-world political figures like Susan Rice next to made-up ones like Martin Meriwether and see how many people are familiar with those. What do you find when you do things like that?
That's right. We like to put people in situations where we know they know nothing about what we're talking about. And the way we do that is we ask them to tell us about fictitious or non-existent people, places, or concepts. So conversation about politics, we'll ask people what they know about Susan Rice, and she exists. She's in the Obama administration. But we'll also ask people about Michael Merrington, and he does not exist in Washington as far as we know. And what we find is people are willing to claim some sort of familiarity with Mr. Merrington, even though he doesn't exist. And the people who are willing to claim some knowledge are those who rate their expertise in politics the highest. So they're prone or vulnerable to making claims of knowledge they can't possibly have.
Now, when I hear about tests like that, or when I watch those Jimmy Kimmel Lie Witness news clips, my gut reaction is to think, yeah, haha, those people, they get things wrong. I'm above that sort of thing. How very wrong am I?
Well, our work and our thinking basically suggests to us that sooner or later, we will be those people. We will switch into their roles. That is, some of us are incompetent in important domains, and we're going to struggle and have trouble. But sooner or later, that fate is going to come to all of us. So sooner or later, each of us is going to be claiming knowledge or acting on knowledge we simply don't have.
Now, in some contexts, like if, somebody gets us on a camera thing like that, it's not a big deal. Does this have serious real-world consequences, do you think?
I think so. I mean, people do act on knowledge they think they have, even though they may not have it. So some recent data I came across were some data about 25,000 people in the United States and their financial habits. And in particular, whether or not they had declared bankruptcy in the last 2 years. And when I dove into the data, what I found is that the people who had filed for bankruptcy had financial literacy that was quite low relative to everybody else. But when you looked at their self-ratings of their financial knowledge, they rated themselves more positively than everybody else, suggesting that not having awareness of deficits in your financial knowledge might be a risk factor.
We're talking to psychology professor David Dunning of Cornell University, talking about why having limited knowledge can actually make us more confident in our opinions and our abilities.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you see this happening in your life, in your work? Have you ever tried to fake an answer rather than own up and say, I don't know? Have you ever confronted a closely held opinion or belief and realized that you'd been wrong all along? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with David Dunning, psychology professor at Cornell University. His recent piece called We're All Confident Idiots is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. His research looks at the ways we overestimate our knowledge and our abilities and finds that often the less we know, the more confident we are.
You can join the conversation with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. Do you see this a lot, the notion of a confident idiot, someone maybe you work with who knows more or thinks they know more than they do, but doesn't quite get it right? Have you ever been in this awkward situation? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller now. We've got Cheryl on the line in Dousman. Cheryl, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I had an experience, a number of college courses in which you come together, or even professional development. I'm a public educator. And a lot of times there's some stress or tension in the area because we're talking about things and we're learning things. And if you're an educator, you're sometimes I think we're supposed to know everything. But when finally someone is brave enough to ask, wait a minute, I don't know what that is, what does that mean? It's like the stress in the room just finally releases and everyone can just be learners on an equal plane instead of having this pretense of, well, I already know this. And that feels good.
Cheryl, thank you so much. Interesting example. David, is this something that you've looked at? There's kind of a groupthink. Nobody wants to be the first one to own up and say they don't get it, even if everybody in the room might be in the same situation.
That's actually studied a little bit in social psychology, where we assume that the calm that everybody else exudes is knowledge when, in fact, they are calm because they don't know what else to do. When I run review sessions with students where they're asking questions, I often tell students right up front that they should ask questions, because if they have the question, at least 20% of the people in the room have the question, and an additional 40% of the people in the room should have that question, but they don't know it yet.
Thanks a lot for that call, Cheryl, at 800-642-1234. Another thing you get into in the piece we're talking about, David, is how we get a mistaken impression, a wrong belief in the first place. And you say that can come back to our very earliest years growing up, that we get this unquestioned assumption that sticks with us. Where does that come from?
Well, we're inveterate theorizers, we're pattern recognizers, and we, start that way way back all the way to birth. I mean, babies are trying to figure out what works, what can they control in the world, what controls them in the world. And they're coming up with theories and hypotheses and so forth about what works. And so they learn things like other human beings can move around the room, but not the computer on the desk. And so they're doing usually a good job of theorizing. But a one-year-old, a two-year-old is going to make some mistakes. And starting from those early years, we'll start to come up with theories that actually will turn out to be hard to shake, even in our adult years.
And talking about shaking theories, especially something that's closely held or a part of our own identity, how hard is it to change that, even when we're confronted with evidence to the contrary of what we think?
Oh, that can be very hard. And, people have cherished beliefs about themselves or cherished beliefs about how they think that the social order in the world should be. And, a lot is built up on those beliefs. And so if you question one of those beliefs, like, I'm a lovable and capable person, a lot else can come shattering down if you play with those beliefs. So those beliefs tend to be well defended. And if you're trying to change those beliefs from the outside, as an educator, for example, or maybe even in therapy, you have to be careful and you have to have some sort of technique to be able to successfully change beliefs that need changing without changing too much else.
Let's get back to our callers. We've got Mike on the line now in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hello, good evening, gentlemen. I was curious. I've got a 14-year-old daughter who does very well in school and very, very confident. And sometimes her confidence leads to her telling some stories now and then. And I don't know if it's stretching the truth or just what she believes to be truthful in her mind, and I'm curious how that relates to the topic.
Mike, thanks for the call. David, so is there a thin line sometimes between an exaggeration that we start to believe in and an intentional lie?
There can be. The interesting case, though, is when the person we're lying to turns out to be ourselves. That is, there are a few exaggerations that after a while become part of our belief system, become part of what we actually believe about ourselves. And sometimes that can be okay, but sometimes that can be a little dangerous. So often when thinking about yourself, it's good to have a little bit of a devil's advocate voice inside your head, actually question anything that you might, any belief that you might hold about yourself that you're unshakably confident about.
Can we train ourselves to have our own inner devil's advocate?
Well, that's the idea. I mean, there are certain habits of mind that people can develop, and everybody is going to have a different style. So, for example, I don't do this with every single decision because it would be too tiring. But when a decision is important enough and I think I know which way to go, I try to project myself into the future and ask, okay, let's say that I made that decision and it turned out to be an utter disaster. What got me to that disaster? What did I overlook? What went wrong? What was the assumption I shouldn't have made? And for myself, for important decisions, I found that to be very helpful in steering me away from decisions that might be a bit too rash. But it's something that I do only when the decision is important enough to expend that sort of energy.
What flavor of gum? Maybe you don't need to go through the process.
No, in fact, for flavors of gum, I say explore them all.
Excellent. Back to our callers now. We've got Irma on the line in Appleton. Irma, hi.
Hi there. And once again, I'm not sure if I'm going to be as eloquent as I want to be, but I come from the corporate world, and I think that the fundamental premise of what you mentioned is that more confident you are, less knowledge you may have in certain areas. Well, I'm just going to take a pragmatic situation where what I observe, and I don't know how true this is, but what I observe is that in the corporate world, where the motives may be a little different at times, depending who's in that meeting from a hierarchy perspective, what's observable is that that confidence, it becomes extremely important to persuade our senior leaders. And therefore, the whole politics of it kind of plays into that confidence. So basically the question is, how do we, there are more complex dynamics that happen
I think I got you, Irma. So sometimes you have to sell a point, play at being more confident than you want to be. So there's an incentive for this false sense of confidence, David.
Yes. I mean, there are situations when it's perfectly appropriate to be confident. That is, in a world in which people can be confident about the wrong idea, the right idea better have some confidence backing it if it's going to win the day. And I think the split between being cautious and confident is that at the moment when it comes time to energize, to persuade, I think, or to have your say, that's when you want to be confident. But you don't want to be too overly confident preparing for that moment. I mean, going through your arguments, doing your research, checking with other people, seeking out advice. There you might want to be potentially even overly cautious so that when the day comes, you are prepared and you have made the best case you can that you have the right idea. So I think confidence absolutely certainly does have its place, but I think it has to be a functioning partner with caution.
And briefly, in a group setting, corporation or otherwise, do we need to have a designated buzzkill to try to tamp down unwarranted confidence?
All I can say is that in medical schools and research labs that have been noted for their productivity and for their excellence, they tend to have such a person, or they have such a meeting where a person or a time is designated for the buzzkill, if you will. And it is a buzzkill. It is unpleasant, mm-hmm. and it can be tense. But what it does is it prevents a lot of buzzkill and tenseness that could happen later on. So that having a devil's advocate or having someone who's there to criticize, whose role is to criticize, I think actually is an important part of any group.
David, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's psychology professor David Dunning of Cornell University. We have a link to his piece under the headline, "We Are All Confident Idiots," on the Central Time Facebook page.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farrad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, it's our monthly check of science news with Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak. Today, we'll learn about some groundbreaking new cancer research.
First, we take a look at a new twist in the battle over net neutrality and the future of the Internet. Earlier this year, FCC regulations over net neutrality, basically the idea that all Internet traffic should be treated equally without fast lanes and slow lanes for certain users, were struck down, leading to fears that service providers might start charging more for certain kinds of traffic.
Today, President Obama is weighing in. He's called on the FCC to enforce more robust regulations on net neutrality, and to do so, he'd like to see the agency reclassify broadband in order to regulate it more like a public utility. So what would that look like, and is it something that the FCC would actually sign off on?
Joining us now is Barry Orton, professor of telecommunications at UW-Madison. Barry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So the president spoke out today, coming out strongly in favor of net neutrality. What did he say?
He basically said that net neutrality is basically fundamental to the people's right to know. And he kind of connected it to the First Amendment, which is a good thing. But he's only one voice in this fight, and maybe not the most important voice.
Right. So technically, the president doesn't actually have sway over the FCC.
No.
Given that, though, how important was this statement of his?
Well, he appoints the chair and he appoints all the members, but by law, two of the members have to be one party and three another. But it was interesting, the response from FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler was the following, among other things he said. He agrees that the Internet must remain open. We both oppose Internet fast lanes, et cetera. But then he said, as an independent regulatory agency, we will incorporate the president's submission into the record of the open Internet proceedings. We welcome comment on it and how it proposes to use Title II of the Communications Act. So, i.e., he's one person who spoke. There's a million people who've spoken so far, and we'll put it into the record. So that's all they did.
So this Title II of the Telecommunications Act, what would that mean using that particular?
That essentially says that the Internet is like the telephone lines, and it becomes a common carrier. And Title II means that it would be essentially regulated as the FCC regulates phone lines, which is how the Internet started in the first place.
All right, so classifying
it's really not that big of a change, but the industries who profit from the Internet, particularly the carriers, Comcast, Time Warner, AT&T, Verizon, are screaming as if this is the worst possible thing that could ever happen. And quite frankly, their voices are quite loud and have quite a bit of impact. I don't know if you've noticed, but Ted Cruz has come out and said, net neutrality is Obamacare for the Internet. The Internet should not operate at the speed of government. So he's already said, and the Republicans are already starting to kind of pile on and say, well, if Obama said it, it's got to be wrong, and so therefore we're against it.
So if this were to happen, if the Internet would be regulated like a public utility, what would broadband Internet look like under this proposal?
It should look very much the same as it looks right now. You pay for Internet service, and then you get as much as you want to watch. And all the stuff comes in equally. Common carrier means that you treat all things that are the same, so you can't speed up Netflix and slow down YouTube. And that's what net neutrality is really all about. It's about competitive advantage for various providers and various carriers.
Now let's take a look at the two sides here. The companies you just mentioned, companies like Verizon and Comcast, and President Obama's concerns, where do they both stand here?
Well, the carriers stand for a much weaker version of net neutrality. It's called Part 706 of the Communications Act, which basically allows the FCC power to do pretty much what it wants to do, but it doesn't have the specific legal authority that Title II does, which is a standard part of the FCC's powers. It's really not challengeable in court. When the AT&T writes a letter and says they don't like Title II, it would change everything, it would negatively impact our infrastructure and our investment, they're complaining an awful lot about something that they've done very well under over the last 20 years. They essentially don't want to have the FCC to have this power over what they see is a tremendous profit center.
And at the core of President Obama's concerns, what is he trying to prevent from happening?
He's trying to prevent fast lanes. He's trying to prevent a internet that really is a tiered structure where those who pay more get more and those who pay less get something that's lower, essentially. And speed is what the internet's about these days, and a slower internet doesn't work as well. So he's trying to prevent kind of a class structure within the internet.
President Obama has said he also wants mobile broadband included in this.
Right.
So as it stands, how is mobile broadband regulated differently than traditional broadband?
At the moment, mobile broadband isn't regulated very heavily. And so the regulation basically is structured on who uses the airwaves, the ability to use certain frequencies. And it doesn't go anywhere beyond that. The fear by the companies who provide it is that they would have a government agency that's going to really kind of dictate to them the terms and conditions under which they offer their services. And that's, in fact, what common carriage is about, is that the government says these things have to be equal. There can't be these kinds of differential structures. As to what's going to happen, we have to remember that the chairman of the FCC made his fortune in the telecom industry, and before that, he was the chief lobbyist first for the cable industry and then for the wireless industry. I think when push comes to shove, you're going to find that the industry voices who have spent an awful lot of money over the last number of years supporting campaigns for Congress will be listened to the strongest. I suspect we'll have some kind of a Band-Aid system with kind of a blended system where some will be regulated and some won't. But I think the industry voices, which the Republican Party is starting to listen to very strongly, will have great sway here.
And we just heard in the NPR newscast that stocks for iCarriers of broadband, places like Charter, Time Warner, are down 4%. Does that lend credence to either side of this argument?
It lends credence to the idea that the marketplace understands that these guys have had a really great monopoly, more or less, and have a really tremendous business. And here, the threat that we might have a more robust net neutrality kind of takes some of the glow off that business, but it's only 3 to 5%. They're still tremendous businesses, no matter how much they're regulated. And so I think that's probably a correct adjustment in terms of the odds of what will happen here. But quite frankly, even if the FCC agrees with the president and goes full bore for net neutrality, the industry has two very good roads to go after that. One is they can sue, and they can go back into the courts, and they've done that successfully over the many years. And two, they'll go right to Congress and get a new law passed that gives them the upper hand. And I suspect that's what's going to happen.
Now, you mentioned the increasing politicization of this, and
yes,
the Republicans, you say, increasingly listening to some of these broadband carriers, President Obama weighing in. So is this essentially going to be, you know, a showdown for Democrats and Republicans?
I don't think so. I suspect that when and if the FCC decides to go with a robust model of common carriage, both parties will find that their campaign contributors will lean towards less regulation, and the Congress can very simply pass a new law that says these guys guys aren't regulatable. And I think in this case, the large contributions that the industries have been making to both parties will pay off for them in many fold.
Barry, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you for having me.
That was Barry Orton, professor of telecommunications at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about President Obama's recent proposal to protect net neutrality.
New cancer research about a gene mutation will be published early next month, and we're getting a preview of some of the info in our monthly check-in on Science Headlines with Gemma Tarlak.
Gemma is senior associate editor of Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to break down some of the coolest science headlines. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Hello, and a happy Monday to you both.
And to you. Well, let's start with the cover story of the December issue of Discover. It's called The Cave of the Crystal Maiden. Well, that sounds intriguing. What's going on there?
Yes. You know, this is the Indiana Jones movie they should have made. This is a great story where our writer, Will Hunt, actually goes with the researcher into these caves. He's like swimming through subterranean rivers and lightless areas to find this 1,000-year-old skeleton that was the victim of a Maya sacrifice. And he, the researcher unravels the story using research from all different fields to figure out that the Maya were actually going sometimes miles and underground into these like caves that had rivers and cliffs and were absolutely lightless to sacrifice animals and also humans. And they figured out the reason they're doing this is because at the time, we're talking about 1,100 years ago, it was just as the Maya civilization was collapsing, and there was a horrific drought. So you're thinking, why are they dragging all these, you know, people and animals and everything into these lightless, horrible caves to sacrifice them? And it turns out their rain god, Chuck, lived in the caves. So it's this incredible kind of archaeological CSI where the researcher from the University of California at Merced kind of pieces together exactly how this poor 20-year-old woman wound up, you know, a quarter mile underground sacrificed. And it's a riveting story, and we've got some fantastic photos with it as well.
And do we know why this rain god lived underground? Is that something the archaeologists have figured out?
Well,
seems like you
know,
want the rain god up above somewhere.
You know, that's the thing about gods. They just do what they want, right? You know, they live where they want. And, but seriously, it's kind of an interesting dichotomy. And part of it was Chuck, who is the rain god, is associated with the Mayan underworld. And because, you know, he could be a bad guy with the lightning strikes and the flooding and everything. So he was kind of a, you know, feared creature. And he lived on the edge of the underworld. So they think that's why the Mayas thought of him as living in this cave environment. But it's a crazy story. And one of the things when I was looking at the story that really stood out to me is we have a great map that shows both the elevation and just the whole topography, if that's the right word, of the cave system. And when you see what these people had to go through, you know, hundreds of years before flashlights, just to get to this spot, you can just really sense their desperation to make it rain.
Now, this is kind of a gruesome question, but how did she die?
They killed her dead. You know, there's been a lot of research done on her skeleton, and I don't want to get into the specifics here.
I see. All right. Mysterious.
Fair enough. A bigger question, though, was you mentioned this is a drought, a long-term drought. Was this some sort of early climate change or just a drift in weather patterns that led to this? Do we know what led to this crisis?
To the crisis of the drought?
Yeah.
Well, what she did was she looked at other researchers' work into this 17-year-long study that just wrapped a few years ago, looking at sediment cores and tree rings and all these different elements. And they just know that there was a sharp and severe drop in rainfall at the beginning of the 9th century. You know, it's hard to say. I mean, it was definitely a change in pattern, and there are all kinds of theories about that, but it's unmistakable. There's no question that there was this real horrible drought.
Moving on to a topic that's very personal for you now, cancer research.
Yeah, we have also a profile of this fantastic researcher, Joanne Wiethaus, who is just relocating her lab to UCLA now. She was at Yale previously. And she's been doing some really amazing work. And as it turns out, the reason I know about her work is because I'm one of the participants in a study. She does a lot of studies into this specific mutation that increases your risk for cancer. And I'm a cancer survivor myself, and my way of kind of like giving back, or as I like to put it, getting back at cancer, is to participate in these studies and just, you know, share my medical information and history in hopes that it can help research in general.
And then her research focuses on one particular gene mutation, is that right?
Yes, she and her cohort, I guess that's the word, Frank Slack, another biologist, they discovered a few years ago this specific mutation called the KRAS variant. And, you know, there's a lot of press about the BRCA, BRCA 1 and 2 breast cancer mutations. And we think of that kind of as a really bad thing because it really changes your breast cancer risk. Well, to put it all in perspective, the BRCA 1 and 2 mutations are found in 1 in 400 people. They do increase your risk of, say, breast cancer, but they're found in 1 in 400 people. But this KRAS variant, the thing Joanne and Frank discovered, it's found in 1 in 20 of us, which, I mean, when you think about the difference, 1 in 400 versus 1 in 20, there's a lot more KRAS variant mutation going around.
So what happens when you have, when you're one of these 1 in 20, you have this KRAS variant, what does it signify?
Well, there's the technical side and then the risk side. So the technical side of it is it means your body cannot control the production of a certain protein, and that out-of-control production can lead to tumor growth. So that's the technical, actually, science behind the scenes, what happens. Now, what does that mean to the average person? Well, if you have the KRAS variant, you're at a much higher risk for a lot of different kinds of cancer. And we go into it in a lot of different greater depth in the magazine, but basically, for example, having the KRAS variant mutation increases a woman's risk of ovarian cancer by more than 27%. It's also found in a lot of really unfortunate people who have multiple types of cancer. It's a very high likelihood that they are KRAS variant positive. And it also, it can affect, having the KRAS variant can affect how well certain types of chemotherapy work on your cancer. So it's a key thing to know, and unfortunately they're having trouble getting it accepted as a standard practice.
So if it were accepted as a standard practice, how would this affect treatment for people who have this biomarker, this KRAS variant?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you, for example, when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, one of the first things they did was they put me through a whole barrage of tests looking for specific genetic mutations and specific identifying factors of the actual tumor. And if KRAS variant became standard practice, they would also be checking patients for that, checking to see if they have that variant. And then, for example, not to get too technical, but say platinum-based chemotherapy, it's one form of treatment. It's shown to be not as effective if you have the KRAS variant. So maybe instead of using that as the first option for chemotherapy, your doctor might try something else. And, you know, the science is very new. They're still, as you mentioned when introducing the topic, she's just presenting some of this at a conference next month in San Antonio. So it's all very new, but it is really fascinating. And I think it's going to really impact a lot of lives.
One interesting angle on this is that Dr. Wiedhaus has had the opportunity more than once to sell the rights to this test to various companies. And she has said no because she wants it to be widely available.
Yes, and you know, that's kind of really speaks to her personality. One of the things I really noticed when I was working with her as a study participant is she personally answers all your emails. And mind you, she had no idea I was a member of the media at the time. I was just, you know, patient 123781 or whatever. But she had a lot of personal interaction and a lot of dedication and real passion for this topic. And, you know, she doesn't want the test to cost $5,000, $6,000 like some of the other tests out there. It costs about $300. And she formed a nonprofit group recently, a nonprofit company, and, you know, anyone can get the test. You do have to order it through your doctor, and it's your doctor who gets the results, but she really wants to make it as accessible as possible to people who could use the information.
And there's been a long-term hunt for, I think at first we thought there might be a cancer gene, and now it seems like we're looking for lots of different cancer genes and indicators and things like that. In the scope of all those out there, is this one a big deal?
You know, I really think it is. And, you know, in the course of my day, I see a lot of journal articles, a lot of, you know, we found this, we found that mutation. And what to me is really striking that she has conducted studies with more than 65,000 people. And this keeps cropping up. I don't know numbers of other studies offhand, but I'm pretty sure this is one of the biggest overall examinations of a potentially cancer-causing mutation. And, you know, she keeps coming up to the same findings. So that to me says that this is really big. Personally, I think it's a bigger deal than, say, BRCA1 or 2, which, again, get a lot of media attention. Some people call them the Angelina Jolie gene because she unfortunately has the BRCA mutation, but I think this is a big deal, and I think people should know about it. You know, whether or not they want to get tested, hey, that's totally up to them. But I think it's very important to know about.
Gemma, in our last moments here, should people who maybe have a history seek out this test? Is that advisable right now?
Well, I'm not a doctor, and I don't even play one on TV. I think that's something you might want to pick up the December issue and take it to your doctor and have a serious discussion. Quite frankly, that's what I did when I saw my doctor recently. I kind of harassed him and said, read this article. And then he immediately flipped to the back page and started reading 20 things you don't know. So I don't know how seriously he took it. But yeah, I think it's really worthwhile to read the article, think about, you know, your family history, cancer if you have one, and make that choice.
Gemma, thanks as always for joining us.
Always fun, guys. See you next month.
That was Gemma Tarlak with Discover Magazine. And you can see Discover's list, by the way, of recommended holiday books. We've got a link on the Central Time Facebook page.